Well, brethren, the book of Daniel has always been one of my favorite books of the Bible. I suppose you could say that of all the prophets, Daniel is my favorite. I just really love to read the book of Daniel. It's not near as long as Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel either. But other than that, to me, it's easier to understand, and I get more inspiration personally out of the book of Daniel. The first six chapters of Daniel contain accounts of faith and courage that never cease to inspire me. And also the last six chapters are quite intriguing. They're filled with apocalyptic visions and prophecies that challenge even the most advanced Bible students and scholars. And I don't pretend to be one of the more advanced Bible scholars. I have had some opportunity, having gone to Ambassador College, to study the Bible and study some prophecy, but there are lots of people who have studied prophecy a whole lot more than I have. The book of Daniel is a very, very interesting and inspiring book, but it's also a book that has been attacked and maligned by many people. It's been attacked by many biblical liberals who will deny its inspiration. It's been maligned by those who cast doubt upon its validity by claiming the stories contained in it are exaggerated or just flat out fabricated. Some Jewish rabbis also discredit the book of Daniel, and I think largely because of the 70 weeks prophecy, which clearly shows the first coming of the Messiah and the timing of Christ's coming. Of course, the Jews do not recognize Jesus Christ as the Messiah, and so that prophecy is particularly troubling to them. When properly read and understood, and most importantly, when believed, the book of Daniel can certainly inspire us to greater faithfulness in our service to God, and it can also strengthen our faith in the inspiration of the Bible. So today I'd like to give some of the historical background regarding the man Daniel, and also the times in which he lived and prophesied. Today we'll have a bit of a history lesson, but we'll also be inspired to follow Daniel's example, and we'll draw faith and courage from his commitment and devotion to the same God that we all serve today. Now, the sources that I've used for this particular sermon, I use the eSword Bible software pretty heavily. If you have a computer and you have the internet, if you haven't used eSword, I would strongly recommend you go to eSword and check it out. It's actually free, and it's got some amazing, it's got whole commentaries that you can download that go right along with this Bible program. In fact, some of the commentaries that we have on our computer is Barnes Commentary, Kiel and Delitzsch, which is a very scholarly work and highly respected. Jameson Fawcett and Brown's Commentary, Clark's Commentary, Henry's Commentary. I think there's one called McGill, and there's a few others that I'm not as familiar with. There's also some Bible dictionaries. It has Easton's Bible Dictionary. It has Fawcett's Bible Dictionary and Smith's Bible Dictionary all on it. And also pastor and historian Mark Copeland also used some of his information in helping compile some of the dates and things that I'll be giving you today. So let's talk about Daniel, first of all. The name Daniel means God is my judge. Some say it means God is judging. There's always a few variations, and different scholars oftentimes will translate it a little bit differently. But it means God is my judge, or God is judging. When we read about Daniel in the book of Daniel, he is being brought to Babylon, taken into captivity, and very likely he was somewhere between 12 or 15 years old, certainly probably a teenager or a very young man. Let's go to Daniel and just read a few of the verses to start with. Book of Daniel. Chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and also 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time, the end of those 3 years, they might serve before the king. Now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now in verse 4 in the New King James, it says young men. But actually, that word is also often translated children. And it says this word properly denotes the period from the age of childhood up to manhood, and might be translated boys, lads, or youth. So very likely he was in his teens. Some of the church fathers, Ignatius, for example, felt that Daniel was just 12 years old. Others say he was, Chrysostom says he was 18. But basically those are conjectures or traditions, but probably not too far from the truth. He was quite young. And also, he could have easily been from the royal line. He could have been of the royal seed. Or if not, he was certainly from a prominent family in Judah. And also quite talented, because those were the ones that they sought out to bring to Babylon to serve in this training program so that they might serve before the king. It doesn't take long, as we read the book of Daniel, to see that Daniel was a young man of deep and abiding faith. He was a man of conviction at a very early age. He also was clearly a leader. And let's read on a little bit further here and we'll see that. It says in verse 7, To them, the chief of the eunuchs gave names, that is to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar, these are Chaldean names and have something to do with a Chaldean god. I'm sure that they would have preferred their own Hebrew names. Didn't really want these other names, but they were given them nevertheless. In verse 8 it says, But Daniel purposed in his heart. This means he was committed, he was convicted, and he was determined. So he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now it's likely that part of the defilement here could be that this food and drink may have been offered to other gods, so it could have been defiled in that manner. Certainly some of the king's delicacies could have included various seafoods that God showed were unclean. It could have also had a nice big roasted pork or something like that. Things that God clearly said were forbidden for his people to eat. So he did not want to defile himself. Now, brethren, I think you and I can learn a lesson just from that little part right there. We as God's people today should not want to spiritually defile ourselves. We shouldn't want to defile ourselves from a physical standpoint either and eat foods that are improper to eat. At the same time, we should strive to not defile ourselves from a spiritual standpoint. And obviously, whenever we sin, we are defiling ourselves. Our goal is to put sin out of our lives. Our goal is to become like God, to become holy as God is holy. I mentioned that in the sermon that I recently gave on the pearl of great price. We have a precious gift that God has given us, that he's revealed to us, and certainly we need to take it to heart and strive to keep from defiling ourselves. Frankly, it's easy to defile oneself in this society. There's an awful lot of defilement out there, a lot of things that are contrary to God and His way and that are actually abomination to Him. And we should strive to distance ourselves from that as much as we possibly can and not become a part of it. In verse 9 it says, "Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs." God was blessing Daniel, but also Daniel was a wise man even at an early age. He was a wise young man. And we'll see this as we read through this account today. He already had favor with the chief of the eunuchs. You see in verse 8 it says he requested of the chief of the eunuchs. He didn't go in demanding of the chief of the eunuchs. He understood his place. He was a captive there. And he humbly requested. Now, even though he had God on his side, he didn't go in there like a bull in a china shop and try to bully his way through. He requested. He respectfully asked. And he already had some goodwill and some favor with the eunuch. In verse 10, though, the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king." Now, I think we can all understand why this chief of the eunuchs was concerned about his own head. Because whenever you mess with the king, back in those days, you know, they had all authority, they had all power, and all it would take is a word from the king, and that's right, off of the head. So he was concerned about his own head and what might become of it if he gave in to this request. So evidently, that's all that was said. And Daniel, it says in verse 11, was persistent, because after the chief of the eunuchs said what he did, then Daniel went humbly again to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel. So Daniel didn't take no for an answer. He respectfully listened. It doesn't say he challenged him. He doesn't say he threw a fit or anything like that. But he went to see the steward who was immediately over them, and he made a proposal, one that would not get the chief of the eunuchs in trouble or the steward. It was a 10-day trial. He says, "Please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants." So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Those things were just too rich and weren't the right type of food to really enhance one's health. So they looked worse than did Daniel and his three friends. In verse 16 it says, "Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables." Now it doesn't say that he told the chief of the eunuchs. I don't know whether he did or didn't, but evidently it worked. And it doesn't seem that there were any repercussions from this. So Daniel shows his persistence. He shows good common sense. But he also shows a desire to please God and to follow through on his purpose, which was not to defile himself. So he was not just a hearer of the word, but he wanted to be a doer of God's word. And so he as a leader stepped out. Verse 17, it says, "As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill." I think God continued to bless them because of their willingness to obey God and to be faithful to Him. That's another lesson that you and I should learn, is that if we'll just step out in faith and trust God and be persistent in our requests, and if we go to God humbly and we go to people humbly, and we rely on God, then God will work things out for us, whether we're children or teenagers or adults. God will hear our prayers, He will hear our requests, and He will bless us as a result of it. So He gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, I'm back in verse 17, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So He gave Daniel even a greater gift. The three friends were given certainly God's blessing, but Daniel was given a greater blessing. Perhaps it was because Daniel was the leader and he was willing to step out in greater faith, even though Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we also know were very faithful people, young men, who were willing to die for God and His way. It says in verse 19 that the king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Those four young men were head and shoulders above everyone else. Therefore, they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all of his realm. So obviously, these young men applied themselves. They were diligent in their studies. They were also close to God, and God blessed them with being able to remember and being able to deal with the things that they had to deal with. So they were 10 times better. Thus, Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus, which was many years to come. So here we see a young man with deep faith, a young man of convictions, a young man willing to do what was necessary to obey God. And later on, we'll probably go to Daniel 6, where Daniel was actually thrown into a den of lions. And Daniel was probably at least 80 years old at the time. He could have been 90 or even older at the time that he was thrown into the lion's den. So he continued to serve God and to be faithful throughout his life and throughout his captivity. So we've already seen that God blessed Daniel because of his faith. Let's go to Daniel 2, verse 48, and we'll see that God blessed him in other ways as well. Daniel 2, verse 48. Now this comes after an incident where Nebuchadnezzar has a dream that is very troubling to him. And he wants the magicians and his people to tell him what the dream is and its interpretation. Now, of course, they don't know what the dream is. And they said in verse 11, "There is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a thing of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean." This was an unheard of thing that Nebuchadnezzar was asking them to do. See, their trick was let the king tell them what his dream is, and they can always come up with what it means. You know, as long as they know what it is, they can fabricate some kind of an answer. But if they don't even know what it is, that's when they're in deep trouble. So in this case, Daniel was lumped in with all of these wise men, and so Nebuchadnezzar's decree was to go ahead and kill them all. If they can't answer this, if they can't tell me my dream and its interpretation, then down with all of them. Well, of course, that concerned Daniel when he heard about it. And Daniel therefore goes to the king. First he asks the king's guard, why is the decree so urgent? He found out, well, it's very urgent because he's going to kill us all if we don't do something. So it says in verse 16 of Daniel 2, Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. Now that was probably difficult to do, but what other choice did he have? So he went into the king and he asked for time. Then Daniel went to his house. And you know, it's interesting what Daniel did then. He didn't just go to his house. Now, I'm getting ahead of myself here on this story. This isn't exactly where I wanted to be. Let's stop that story right there and we'll get back to it. Let's go to verse 48. This happens because Daniel does, he is able to tell the king his dream and the interpretation, and so he's promoted as a result. In Daniel chapter 2, verse 48, it says, "Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, and he made him chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon." So he was catapulted above all of the other Babylonians and astrologers and magicians and so forth, chief advisors who had been there that the king had known for years, and Daniel was catapulted above them. So we see again that he's blessed because of his faithfulness. And also it says in verse 49 that Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So Daniel didn't forget his friends either when the time came. Daniel was blessed again because of his faith. He served as a statesman, a counselor to kings, and a prophet of God. Now, another point I wanted to bring out about Daniel is that not only was he a good leader, but he also selected the very best of friends and surrounded himself with other young men of faith and courage, the men that we've been talking about, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Or Shadrach, it seems like we know them better by their Babylonian names, but we probably really should know them better by their Hebrew names. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. In back to Daniel 2, in verse 16, where we already read about Daniel and that he went to the king, asked for more time. And then it says in verse 17, "Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions." So Daniel just didn't try to go alone with this thing. Obviously, he knew he needed God's help, but he also sought the help of his friends. And I think that's a valuable lesson that you and I need to learn, is that we should have friends in God's church, people of like mind, that when we have a trial, when we have a problem, we also seek them out and ask them for their prayers, ask them to go to God on our behalf. It seems like some people are reluctant to ever get other people involved in any of their problems or their trials. They want to do it alone. You know, it's just me and God. That's not always the best approach. There are times when we should bring our wife or our husband into our confidence or other brethren and ask them to pray for us. I think the United Church of God is setting a good example in that regard. Seems like every week we have many prayer requests, people asking for people of like mind to go to God and beseech God on their behalf. So Daniel did that with his three friends, verse 18, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then verse 19, it says, "Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision, so Daniel blessed the God of heaven." And this shows something else about Daniel's character. Daniel didn't forget God. Daniel didn't take the credit and say, "Look how great I am because I figured this out. You know, I know what your dream was, King, and I also know the interpretation of it." He obviously was very sincere when he goes to God and he says in verse 20, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we ask of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand." And then Daniel went to the king and discussed it and told him about his dream and so forth. And that's when he was promoted. This was the dream about Image, the great image. In fact, believe it or not, I did do special music once in my life. I didn't actually sing special music, but I was at Ambassador College and I was in a voice class. And Dr. Eugene Walter, I'm not sure exactly the last name, but I think it was Walters. Anyway, he had us, had our class, it was a small class of about maybe 15 guys, something like that. We did a reading, and we read basically this part of Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, and the height was 6 cubits and 3 cubits. And we went on, it was like a whole chapter of this reading that we did together. And it was a lot of fun to do, but they didn't have a lot of confidence in us because they recorded it ahead of time. And they played the recording, which was stupid. It would have been a lot better if they had just trusted us and let us do it on our own, because I think it was pretty obvious that it was a lip sync kind of a thing going on. But that's the only time I've ever had an opportunity to do special music. But I still remember a good portion of that, that little reading about this image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. And he set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. My wife was hoping I wouldn't do that, but got to spice these sermons up a little bit, you know? All right. Okay, now let's talk about Daniel was contemporary with a number of other prophets. He was contemporary with Jeremiah and also with Ezekiel. Daniel lived approximately, and this is only approximately, and I should have checked what the Bible reading program said about the dates on this. So these may be a little different from what the Bible reading program says, but it's difficult to get any scholars that will really agree exactly on the dates. You know, they're different ones come up with different dates. So I'm just giving you approximate dates today. Don't hold me completely accountable here. Somewhere around 620 to 534 BC. And he could have lived longer than that. You know, it's not totally clear, but he was a ripe old age before he died. Now, Usher's chronology says that 606 BC is the third year of Jehoiakim's reign. So if the third year of Jehoiakim's reign was 606, and that's when Daniel would have been taken to Babylon and he was a teenager, then if he was born in 620, he would have been 14 years old. So that should be close. Now, Jeremiah prophesied in Jerusalem before and during the Babylonian exile. So around the same time. He was older. Jeremiah and Ezekiel were older than Daniel was. Jeremiah was prophesying before the Babylonian exile, and he continued to prophesy during the exile as well. Also, Ezekiel prophesied in Babylon among the exiles. Somewhere around 592 to 570 is what the commentators say in terms of the time that he was actually prophesying. Now, one commentary that I had had Jeremiah prophesying from 626 to 528 BC, which would have been a period of about 98 years. So I don't know if he really prophesied that long or if he was that old or not, but it's somewhere in that ballpark. Daniel prophesied in the capital of Babylon somewhere around 605 to 586 BC. Very little is known about Daniel's personal life outside of the book of Daniel itself. We know that he descended from one of Judah's prominent families, possibly even of royal blood. And we know that at an early age he was brought to Babylon and that he served there. We don't know even if he was married or not. The Bible doesn't really say, doesn't mention a wife. Let's talk about some other things that were happening around this approximate time period to give you a better feel for what was going on. Some other key dates to remember. In 612 BC, that's when Nineveh fell, the capital of Assyria. Now, you all are familiar with the book of Jonah, and Jonah prophesied about Nineveh. Nineveh eventually did fall, but they did repent for a time. And they fell around 612 BC. Assyria had ruled the world since the days of Tiglath-Pileser, which was around 845 BC. So for a couple hundred years, they were at the top, Assyrians. Nabopolassar came to the throne in Babylon, and he rebelled against the Assyrians in 625 BC. And then Nebuchadnezzar, who was the son of Nabopolassar, he was the general who led the Babylonian army against Nineveh, defeating it in 612 BC. Now, a few years later, in 605 BC, is the Battle of Carchemish. And this really establishes Babylonian domination in the world. At the Battle of Carchemish, Pharaoh Necho of Egypt came to fight the Babylonians at Carchemish. Nebuchadnezzar defeated the Egyptians there, chasing them south through Judah. At Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar heard of his father's death, and he returned to assume the throne in Babylon. And around that time is when the first group of Jewish captives were taken. Of course, Daniel and his friends along with that group. And then around 597 BC, a few years later, a second remnant is taken to Babylon. So there are actually three waves of people that were taken from Jerusalem or from the land of Judah to Babylon. Daniel was in the first wave, then the second wave came around 597 BC, and there was about 10,000 Jews that were transported to Babylon at that time. We can read about that in 2 Kings chapter 24. 2 Kings chapter 24. Go with me there. 2 Kings chapter 24. Let's read in verse 8. 2 Kings 24, verse 8. Jehoiachin, or Jeconiah, was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for just 3 months. Now, Jehoiachin followed the reign of his father Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim was the one who was king at the time when Daniel was sent to Babylon. And then his son came along. He was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for just 3 months. So for a very short time. And then Nebuchadnezzar took him and 10,000 Jews to Babylon. Verse 9 it says, And Jehoiachin did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father had done. At that time the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against the city as his servants were besieging it. Then Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, his mother, his servants, his princes, and his officers went out to the king of Babylon. And the king of Babylon, in the 8th year of his reign, took him prisoner. And he carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. Now, we read earlier that some of the treasures were already taken in the first wave. And then here it says that all of the treasures were taken. Now, I don't know if that all is conclusive here. There may have been others. There may have been some left, but the majority of it was taken here the second time. And he cut in pieces all the articles of gold which Solomon the king of Israel had made in the temple of the Lord, as the Eternal had said. Also he carried into captivity all Jerusalem, all the captains and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives and all the craftsmen and smiths. None remained except the poorest people of the land. So it was the poor people that were left behind. And he carried Jehoiachin captive to Babylon. The king's mother, the king's wives, his officers, and the mighty of the land he carried into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. See, it was effective to get the more prominent people out of the land, transport them, bring them into a new land where you can keep a closer watch on them. the poor of the poorer people of the land are easier to control, and so they were left behind. Also, they can work the land, so they can pay tribute to the king. It says in verse 16, all the valiant men, 7,000, and craftsmen and smiths, 1,000, all who were strong and fit for war, these the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon. The second group of captives also included Ezekiel, the prophet Ezekiel. In Ezekiel chapter 1, it just talks about that. So we'll go briefly to Ezekiel chapter 1. Ezekiel chapter 1. Ezekiel chapter 1, let's see, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the 4th month, on the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kebar, that the heavens were open, and I saw visions of God. On the 5th day of the month, which was in the 5th year of King Jehoiachin's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kebar, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. So Ezekiel was a part of that group in the second captivity that were taken into Babylon. And then in 586, Jerusalem falls completely at that time, 586 BC, and that's when the temple is destroyed and Jerusalem falls. Zedekiah was installed as king in Jerusalem, but he was a weak and a vacillating king. And in 2 Kings, it talks about this circumstance where Jerusalem is totally devastated during the time of Zedekiah. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 25. 2 Kings 25, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the 9th month of his reign, that's Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. We see that in verse 20. And then it came in the 9th year of his reign, in the 10th month, on the 10th day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came against Jerusalem and encamped against it, and they built a siege wall against it all around. So the city was besieged until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. So for a couple of years, the city is besieged. By the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine had become so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. Then the city wall was broken through, and all the men of war fled at night by the way of the gate between the two walls, which was by the king's garden, even though the Chaldeans were still encamped all around against the city, and the king went by way of the plain. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king, and they overtook him in the plains of Jericho. All of his army was scattered from him. They took the king, and they brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and they pronounced judgment on him. Then they killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and they put out the eyes of Zedekiah. So that's the last thing that he sees, is his sons being killed. And they bound him with bronze fetters and took him to Babylon. Now, of course, he had been evil in God's sight and had disobeyed God, and God allowed him to go into captivity. Verse 8, and in the 5th month, on the 7th day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. So 19 years had passed since King Nebuchadnezzar had taken over the reins from Assyria. Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, also came to Jerusalem, and he burned the house of the Lord and the king's house, all the houses of Jerusalem, that is, all the houses of the great. He burned with fire, and all the army of the Chaldeans. Remember, the poor of the land were left there, but the ones who were great, had the big homes and all that, those were destroyed. And all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls of Jerusalem all around. So at this point, a third group is taken into Babylonian captivity then. But Jeremiah, the prophet, was not among those people. He was among those who stayed behind. He was with the poor of the land. That's in 2 Kings 25, verse 11. Where we just left off here, 2 Kings 25:11. Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive the rest of the people who remained in the city and the defectors who had deserted to the king of Babylon with the rest of the multitude. But the captain of the guard left some of the poor of the land as vine dressers and farmers. Then verse 22, if we'll drop down to verse 22. Then he made Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, governor over the people who remained in the land of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had left. And then when we go to Jeremiah 39, it'll tie this in. Jeremiah 39. Jeremiah 39, verse 11. Now Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, gave charge concerning Jeremiah to Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, saying, take him and look after him, and do him no harm, but do to him just as he says to you. So Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, sent Nebuchadnezzar, Rabsaris, Nergal-Sharishar, Rabmag, and all the kings of, some interesting names, and all the kings of Babylon's chief officers. Then they sent someone to take Jeremiah from the court of the prison and committed him to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, that he should take him home. So he dwelt among the people. And it says, meanwhile, the word of the Lord had come to Jeremiah while he was shut up in the court of the prison. And of course, God expected him to continue to prophesy. And Jeremiah was very young. Remember when God called him, it says even from his mother's womb, he had been called out to serve God. So there were three waves of Israelites or Jews that went into Babylon, that were taken captive and taken into Babylon. But there were also three groups that came back to Judah. The first group is in 536 BC. The first group is around 536 BC. Excuse me. In 536 BC, the first remnant returns to Jerusalem. Now, Daniel stays in captivity in Babylon. Of course, he had a great deal of power himself while he was there. But he stays there and serves the king and does as God instructs him to do while he's there. Babylon had fallen in 539 BC to the Medes and the Persians. Cyrus, the king of Persia, sends the first remnant back under the leadership of Zerubbabel. You've heard of Zerubbabel. We're not going to go there, but in Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, and also in chapter 2, you can read about that particular return to Jerusalem when Cyrus, the king of Persia, sent the first group back. Also, the foundation of the temple was soon started, but the temple was not completed until 516 BC, some 20 years later, because they were lax about taking care of business. You can read about that in Ezra chapter 3 and also in chapter 6. And then in 457 BC is when a second remnant returns to Jerusalem. A second remnant comes back to Jerusalem. Ezra the priest returns with this group. So Ezra is with this group. Zerubbabel was with the first group. And he also leads a much needed revival in Ezra. It talks about that in Ezra 7 and Ezra 9. And then just a few, about 13 years later, in 444 BC, a third remnant returns to Jerusalem. This group is led by Nehemiah. And you can read about that in Nehemiah chapter 1. Now, under Nehemiah's leadership, the walls of Jerusalem are rebuilt. And together with Ezra, he and Nehemiah restore much of the religion at that time. You can read about that in Nehemiah 8. So Daniel was living through much of these times that we've discussed, not all of this time, but as I mentioned earlier, probably somewhere between 620 and 534 BC. So he was probably around at least during the first remnant that came back to Jerusalem. But he was not among that group that returned. He continued there over the entire 70 years of captivity. In Daniel chapter 1, verse 21, remember I said that he was there until Cyrus. So that was many years later. You don't need to go back there, but Daniel 1:21 points that out. And then in Daniel 10, verse 1, see what Daniel 10, verse 1. Daniel 10 says, in the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel. So Daniel was obviously still there at this time, whose name was called Belteshazzar. And then in Jeremiah 25, it talks about the captivity being 70 years in length. Jeremiah 25, verse 11. Jeremiah 25, verse 11. And this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Now this is Jeremiah who's prophesying before this takes place, obviously. He says it'll be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon for 70 years. So in the Babylonian captivity is 70 years, and then the Persian captivity continues from there. Now some of them are sent back, but there's still some that are still captive in Babylon under the Persians, and Daniel was one of those men. Also Jeremiah 29 verse 10. Jeremiah 29 verse 10. For thus says the Lord, after 70 years are completed at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you and cause you to return to this place. So Daniel's hanging around during this time in Babylon for many years. Ezekiel also talks about Daniel briefly. Ezekiel chapter 14. You can see the esteem that Ezekiel had for Daniel. Ezekiel 14, verse 14. He says, even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, says the Lord God. And then also in verse 20 of the same chapter, even though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, as I live, says the Lord God, they would deliver neither son nor daughter, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness. So here he equates Daniel with Noah and Job, all righteous men. Also in chapter 28 of Ezekiel, verse 3, he also makes mention of the wisdom of Daniel. He's talking to the king or the prince of Tyre here, and I don't know if this is tongue-in-cheek. It could well be that he was being sarcastic here. He says, behold, you are wiser than Daniel, in verse 3. He says it because in verse 2 he says, you are a man and not a god, though you set your heart as the heart of a god. And then he says, behold, you are wiser than Daniel. The point being that Daniel was known as a very wise man, and Ezekiel mentions him here. I wanted to go to Daniel chapter 6 and also discuss that account briefly. I find that a very fascinating account. There's, you know, many, many other places we could go to in the book of Daniel. But remember, Daniel's probably in his 80s, maybe 90 years old, or even older at this time. Daniel chapter 6. This is after the Persians have taken control of Babylon. It says in verse 6, this was right after the fall of Babylon. Verse 31 of chapter 5 says, Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. And over these three were three governors, of whom Daniel was one. that the satraps might give account to them, so that the king would suffer no loss. Thus this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. Of course, that excellent spirit was God's spirit, and he also had a good attitude that went along with that spirit of God. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. He was giving thought to making him over everything. It says in verse 4, so obviously he had made a big impression on the king. Daniel had. So he was liked by the king. Verse 4, it says, the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. They couldn't find a thing. You know, he was not a dishonest man. He kept the laws of the Chaldeans. You know, and there are many laws that man has copied from God, like thou shalt not kill and thou shalt not steal. Laws such as that were well and good. And, of course, Daniel was in compliance with all of these laws, and he was a very faithful, honest person. Then in verse 5 it says, then these men said, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Now, wouldn't it be great if that's the only thing that anyone could ever find fault in you? The only fault that they could find in you is that you obeyed God. You wouldn't eat certain things that God said you shouldn't eat. Or you wouldn't bow down and worship an image, or you wouldn't break God's Sabbath day. You would adhere to God's Sabbath day and keep it holy, and you wouldn't get involved in pagan customs. Well, they realized that the only way that they were going to find something on Daniel is to find it in his religion. Against, or something concerning the laws of God. Verse 6, so these governors and satraps thronged before the king. They conspired, and they said to him, King Darius, live forever. Of course, they were flattering the king, although that was a very common expression. Even Daniel uses that expression. Verse 7, he says, all the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish this decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So they were appealing to King Darius or Darius's vanity. They were appealing to his pride. And he had forgotten about Daniel. Even though he really cared for Daniel, he was not wise enough to figure out what these men were doing. So he agreed and he signed it. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. So since a teenager, Daniel had been praying this way, and he wasn't about to stop now. Not just because the king had signed a decree that couldn't be altered. I think that's a good example for those who are perhaps looking for jobs, and the employer wants you to compromise and not observe the Sabbath, work a little bit on the Sabbath. Obviously, that's not the approach we should take. We should stick to what the God says. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work. The Sabbath is holy and sanctified and set apart. I firmly believe that God will always bless those who obey him. Now, that doesn't mean they won't have to wait a while. It doesn't mean that they won't have to continue to prove their faith as they wait on God to take care of them. Now, at the same time, I think we should use wisdom when we're seeking a job. We shouldn't just throw the Sabbath out and the first thing when we talk to an employer and say, yeah, and I can't work any Saturdays ever. Forget it. None. Ever. You know, that's not probably the best approach right off the bat. Now, you may have to do that eventually. But if you antagonize them right away, then you're not ever going to, you know, if they see that you're a good worker and you work for them a while and you've worked with them 2 or 3 months and then they ask you to do something on the Sabbath and you say, well, can't do it. Sorry. I don't work on the Sabbath. If you have a good track record, then you've got some leverage then. They want to keep good workers. So I think we have to use wisdom when we approach looking for a job. And if they don't ask a lot of questions, I think in some cases we don't necessarily have to volunteer everything. You have to use your own wisdom when it comes to that, your own discretion. Obviously, you can't mislead or lie or anything like that. That wouldn't be appropriate. On the other hand, it's always good to use some good common sense and wisdom when you're seeking work. So in this case, of course, Daniel wasn't going to compromise, and so he was praying to God. And of course, they ran just like Satan, the accuser of the brethren, would do. They ran and accused him before the king. Now the king did have a relationship with Daniel, and he was not pleased with these men who were bringing this issue up about Daniel. So they went before the king. They spoke concerning the king's decree in verse 12 and said, "Have you not signed a decree?" and so forth and so on. And the king answered and said, "The thing is true according to the law of Medes and Persians. It will not alter." So they answered and said before the king that that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. Obviously to the true God and not to some man or some other God. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself. Now to me, this is a king that obviously God is working with to a point, to a degree. Not that he was totally following God, because he wasn't. But at least he was displeased with himself. And he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. He really did respect Daniel a great deal. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men approached the king and said to the king, "Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree which the king establishes shall be changed." So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel, and they cast him into the den of lions. Of course, again, I'm sure that the king was not real pleased that they were continuing to push this issue. He was trying to give Daniel a reprieve. They were not allowing that to happen. So he had to give in, he had to follow his law. And then he says, "Cast him in." But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, "Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you." So the king had some faith in this God of Daniel. Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring, and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. He didn't spend the night in drinking or anything else. He spent the night fasting. Obviously, a lot of Daniel had rubbed off on him already. And no musicians were brought before him. Also, his sleep went from him. He was not able to sleep. He fasted all night. He beseeched God as best he could. And it says, "The king arose very early in the morning, and he went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice." Now, he had faith, but not tremendous. He didn't have perfect faith, because he didn't cry out with a joyous voice. He cried out with a lamenting voice, because he was afraid that Daniel was now being digested by a number of lions. You know, it's interesting to wonder what happened with Daniel that night in there with all those lions, who were obviously very hungry. Because, well, let's just read on. The king says, the king spoke to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to deliver you from the lions?" Then Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you." Now the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, but because he believed in his God. Now I wonder if Daniel had any conversation with those lions that night. I don't know that he was in there petting them. But he might have said something like, you know, why don't you just leave me alone? Because I'm a scrawny old man. I've been eating vegetables and things all my life. He was probably lean. He said, you know, if you leave me alone, I have a feeling that you'll have a big meal tomorrow. Because there are a lot of fat porkers that have been eating pork and seafood and other things. And if you'll just be patient, then you're going to be able to eat them tomorrow in the morning. you know, that's a lot of license there that I'm taking. I doubt if that conversation took place, but regardless, God obviously protected Daniel. And then in verse 24, it says, and the king gave the command that, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives. And of course, sometimes the sins of the fathers are brought upon the family, and this is certainly a case here. So they and their children and their wives, they were all thrown in, and the lions overpowered them and broke all of their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. So all these lions were there, and all these people were thrown in, and none of their bones, they were all broken in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. So it wasn't a pleasant sight for those who sought to have Daniel murdered or killed. And then a fascinating letter is written by King Darius. King Darius wrote a letter. He said to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all of the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So it's really quite fascinating that this king, even though he didn't fully understand God and who he is, he understood enough of who the true God is because of his relationship with the prophet Daniel. So, brethren, I hope you've found this sermon to be interesting. Obviously, there's a lot more that could be said about the book of Daniel, and probably other accounts will be discussed in sermons in the future, either by me or other men. But let's continue to read the book of Daniel. If you haven't read it in quite a while, then I would strongly suggest you read it again, because it is a very, very intriguing book. And Daniel has some characteristics that each and every one of us need to emulate.